been doing in the various catastrophes of society? What became of liberalism? What has conservatism produced in either its enlightened or its reactionary form? If we are indeed honestly to weigh out the bankruptcies of ideology, we shall have a long task ahead of us, and nothing is finished yet. Victor Serge, you ask, who now reads his memoirs? Or his once famous novel of Catalonia, Birth of Our Power? Who recalls that his Kafka-like novel of the Stalin terror, the case of Comrade Tulayev, is the probable, in fact I think certain, literary ancestor of Darkness at Noon? At our century's close, he has simply joined the Greek Kalends. Many of my predecessors at this distinguished podium have spoken of this now expiring century as a period uniquely terrible in human history. The century of the inhuman, George Steiner went so far as to term it, but in very few other things, he was and is at one with the late Isaiah Berlin, who was also wont to speak with some emphasis about the great systems of terror and extermination which had disfigured and nearly destroyed civilization. Auschwitz and the Gulag, now frequently twinned, almost as a commonplace, conversational pairing, as if they might denote some horrific culmination of modernism, the harnessing of cruelty to science and mechanization. Now, I obviously did not open with Victor Serge because I thought that the lessons of totalitarianism, as we like to call it, are not forbidding in the extreme. But one may register two differences with the emerging consensus about what the midnight of the century, the era of the Hitler-Stalin Pact, which was itself the product of the banal evil of the Munich Agreement, really signified. In her celebrated essay, The Concentration Camps, published in Partisan Review in 1948, Hannah Arendt discussed David Rousset's now-forgotten masterpiece, L'Univers Concentrationnaire, the universe of the concentration camp, and suggested chillingly that, and I quote, the next decisive step in the preparation of living corpses is the murder of the moral person in man. This is done in the main by making martyrdom, for the first time in history, impossible. The Western world has hitherto, even in its darkest periods, granted the slain enemy the right to be remembered as a self-evident acknowledgement that we are all men, and only men. It is only because even Achilles set out for Hector's funeral, only because the most despotic governments honored the slain enemy, only because the Romans allowed the Christians to write their martyrologies, only because the church kept its heretics alive in the memory of men, that all was not lost and never could be lost. That's the end of Hannah Arendt's excerpt. And now the revered shade of Hannah Arendt is ever present in the corridors of the New School for Social Research in New York, where I teach. So it's with some diffidence that I say that her passage is, in two senses of the term, overwrought. In the first place, may we not fairly safely say that the millions of victims are done copious honor in our day and given regular recognition, certainly to an extent that would have astonished those among them who thought at the time that they were indeed dying or suffering anonymously and in vain. The concept of martyrdom would certainly have been alien to many, if not most of them. In the second place, is it not quite mistaken to say that the notion of erasure and obliteration as the counterpart to extermination is a novel concept? Of ancient slavery, George Orwell noted that we only have two proper names, Aesop the Fabulist and Spartacus the Rebel, and that, and I'm quoting him now, the rest have gone down to utter silence. In antiquity, and even in the medieval period, there was also an element of terror and oppression that we are poorly equipped even to imagine. When told that plague was caused by Jews or that massacres were divinely ordained, not only the ignorant masses, but the majority of the learned were in no very strong position to doubt it. A pall of fear and ignorance, coerced and inflicted, and partly man-made fear and ignorance, hung over all human activity. For decades after the 30 Years' War, great tracts of Europe and great cities were a physical and moral wilderness given over to the wolves. But only months after the revelation of all the horrors of 1945, enough human reason and technique had survived for for an impressive process of reconstruction to begin, a process that I believe has not yet culminated, but has every prospect of culminating, hopefully. The root cause of all absolutism and all totalitarianism, as well as the chief justification for torpor and for fatalism about such matters as slavery and exploitation, lies in the religious and the worshipping impulse. But over large areas of the globe today, that admittedly ineradicable prompting and impulse is weaker, or under more control, or under better control, than it has ever been. Millions of people lead ethical lives without any help at all from any church. This is a cultural achievement that deserves far more celebration than it receives. In some areas, attempts to recreate the total state have been made by the faithful, and in one case, that of benighted Afghanistan, they can boast briefly of a success, if they dare to boast at all. But overall, monotheism has been exposed as a positively futile, as well as a positively immoral scheme for the ordering of society. A few years ago, you will recall, we were being warned to expect a premillennial upsurge of superstitious panic. No such upsurge has occurred, or is now likely to occur. There is a glitch in the odometer for the year 2000, but it turns out to be a technical one, and therefore fixable in principle as well as in practice. It is impossible, absent some unforeseeable human calamity that would destroy all learning and all evidence, to picture a time when the evil sway of faith could be restored. We live instead in a time when physics is far more awe-inspiring than any religion, and very much more likely to disclose for us the origins and the meanings of the universe. We also live in a time when the more interior study of the shimmering and hitherto elusive ribbons of DNA has allowed us for the first time to give scientific definition to the term our common humanity. If the proper study of mankind is man, we are about to elucidate true human nature and to find in the process that all the rubbish of creationism and of biological racism can be consigned to the dustbin. It is these two endeavors, the mapping of the cosmos and the mapping of our own constitutive identity, that give authentic promise to the otherwise rather overhyped talk of globalization. Now, in order that I not sound like Dr. Pangloss, you'll remember Dr. Pangloss, Condide's over-optimistic advisor who believed that all was for the best and the best of all possible worlds, and in order, in other words, not to sound too cheerful, I should point out that we are, of course, capable of alienating ourselves even from our own highest achievements. It's a cliche to say that nuclear physics still threatens us with annihilation, but such does remain the case. In other words, a process of innovation and experiment that was inaugurated largely by humanistic Jewish refugee scholars has the potential for an erasure of memory and an erasure of humanity far more frightful than anything imagined by Hannah Arendt or put into practice by Stalin. The Greeks used to refer to the Furies as Eumenides, the kindly ones, in the hope of appeasing them. We allude, much more fatuously, to the protection of a nuclear umbrella, my personal favorite among the stupid euphemisms of our time, and to the more than possible outbreak of a really total war as a nuclear exchange. The spread, the globalizing, if you will, of this insane system, and the promiscuity of liberal democracies in helping to forward the spread is the greatest reproach to all of our claims and attainments, while the silence that attends this proliferation looks suspiciously like denial. To stay in the anti-Panglossian column for a moment, I must also revert to the grimmer aspect of an earlier theme and mention the recrudescence of slavery. A recent book by an American scholar who's domiciled in this country, named Kevin Bales, delineates the circles of a hell on earth at the existence of which we do not have to speculate theologically. He computes the number of actual slaves toiling on this planet at this moment at 27 million. Disposable People, which is the title of his extraordinary book, is a dry understatement of the true situation. The slaves of our modern world are, of course, disposable because their ranks are easily replenished and easily maintained by debt and by indentures. Many children are necessarily born into the system, mocking our claims about child abuse and rendering obscene our babble about family values and the protection of the innocent. We are linked to the institution of slavery by the nexus of, and here it comes again, globalization. It is the incessant demand for cheaper goods and services by the poorer citizens of the richer nations, and the poor citizen in the rich nation is my working definition of what it is to be a consumer, that conditions the supply. And it's the moral neutrality of neoliberal political economy that does the rest. The connection is so intimate as to be almost carnal, certainly involving or implicating more average citizens than did the commerce between the squire and his Antigua estates in Mansfield Park. And yet here enters the difference. Only a matter of two centuries ago, philosophers of the caliber of John Locke were prepared to make generalized moral defenses of slavery. Many less sophisticated people, less sophisticated even than Thomas Carlyle, were willing to excuse the practice, and therefore in part to excuse themselves, by reference either to paternalism or to racist fatalism, or some combination of the two. In other words, it could be, and it was argued, that slaves were either incapable of freedom because of their childlike character, or that they were destined for bondage by an ancestral or biblical curse. Now, the great thing, if I may be allowed the phrase, the great thing about the present horror of slavery is that it appears to us in the light not just of an abomination or an anachronism, but as something for which no rational defense may or can be found. And this is partly why it must hide under other names. With the odd exception of Mauritania, where a primitive ethnic-based ideology permits light-skinned Muslims to do to dark-skinned ones what their Christian counterparts used to do, while we may be utterly sure, not omitting regular attendance at prayer, no state or system actually justifies bonded labor, any more than any state or system actually proclaims that it has the right to inflict torture. However, and until recently, one state did ask the International Court for exemption from the general prohibition on the torture and maltreatment of prisoners, and that one state was Israel. Here, if you like, was an irony, that a state made up quite largely of survivors and refugees would plainly, even calmly, announce that it officially employed hideous means of coercion and interrogation. And then, just this past July, the Israeli Supreme Court not only named and identified the practice, but unanimously forbade it. And all at once, the whole miasma of apologia, other states do it, democracy must defend itself, special threats call for exceptional powers, anyway it's not really torture, that whole miasma of apologia was dissipated and discredited. One hopes that the overseas propagandists for the state, who had both denied and justified torture, felt appropriately ashamed. By definition, said the Israeli judiciary, an open society must refuse certain measures. Now, torture inflicted by Jews has or had, in common with some other phenomena I've mentioned, the distinction of being justified by its reference to the most elevated ideals. Atom splitting can be diverted to warlike purposes on the consoling liberal theory of deterrence. Since a rising tide, it is said, lifts all boats, a touch of slavery is a small price to pay for an expanded global economy, more horizontally and vertically integrated. And Israel, survivor state of a martyred people, is entitled to moral exemption in its own defense. The consequences of liberal delusions can be every bit as ruinous as the consequences of millennial or visionary or fanatical or, so to say, ideological ones. Sir Edward Grey and Georges Clemenceau do not figure in everybody's roster of our century's monsters, but the Holocaust they helped to unleash was no less a Holocaust for all that. And globalization has been a cliche ever since J.A. Hobson, the liberal theorist of imperialism, noticed a century ago that all the known world had for the first time either been conquered or annexed. It was actually the exiled Lenin who paid the keenest attention to this finding, and who also noticed its highly suggestive corollary, that henceforth, with no new frontiers, there would be a protracted power struggle over spheres of influence. The mere fact of globalization, then, is no guarantee in itself of unity or of comity. We already know that we live in a global economy, where invisible hands, and even some visible ones, connect our purchases and our investments to the labors of people we will never have to meet. Do we live in a global society rather than an economy? Or do we even think in ways that might prefigure it? Obviously not, or not much, or perhaps better say, not enough. The most encouraging sign, though, is in the area to which I've just alluded, the quite rapid emergence of a single standard for human rights. We use the phrase 19th century optimism without irony. There is no term for 20th century optimism, a suggestive lacuna. But perhaps, without incurring the risk of Panglossianism, there ought to be one. Macaulay, writing in the last century, was more than anything impressed by the extension of what we would now call compassion in matters social and matters penal. Who can fail to be impressed in this decade by the parallel extension of justice? There is no more immunity for the frowning great. The last vestige of divine right has been stripped from our rulers. Meanwhile, even the most lowly and immiserated civilians in Kosovo and Timor have been placed, belatedly enough, it's true, and not without hypocrisy, but nonetheless placed under the protective care of an international authority. At this podium recently, Mary Robinson argued forcefully and passionately for a system of prevention or of prophylaxis that would anticipate war crimes and war criminals. Who can forget the Clinton-Albright administration and its UN veto of any such actions or preventions in Rwanda? Nonetheless, there are already some prefigurations of an early warning force, and they reside in another informal global nexus of non-governmental and voluntary organizations whose logos and jeeps now turn up everywhere that the human race disgraces itself. And underpinning this in turn, and here the global economy does somewhat prefigure a global society, is a vast and growing, expanding system of informal, self-managed communications. 10 years ago, unforgettably, some of us received faxes sent by the embattled students of Tiananmen Square and realized that in its literal sense, the word censorship had become obsolete. But how primitive those once highly advanced faxes now appear. In America, there's now a Burmese democracy website, which is impalpably but unmistakably eroding the walls of one of the world's last closed societies. There are, subjectively as well as objectively, no such things anymore as internal affairs. From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, and from the Atlantic to the Urals, there is no capital city where any ruling elite can forbid public meetings or impose any convincing control over debate. And who would have made that prediction 15 years ago? In less fortunate lands, it remains the case that a cry for help will, even with agonizing delay, be heard. I'll pause again to dip my flag in salute to those who withstood the midnight of this century and who nurtured the Liberty Tree without any expectation of sharing in its fruits. All I have is a voice, wrote W. H. Auden in September 1939, to undo the folded lie, the lie of authority. The essential lie of modern dictatorship, that it can deliver goods at the mere cost of some frivolous liberties, has been conclusively, one might say historically, refuted. The goods don't come, the liberties do get taken away. No doubt this battle will need some refighting, but it is, in every essential point, a battle already won. And those who saw and grasped those points sometimes only intuitively, from George Orwell to Victor Serge, were by no means prone to self-satisfaction about the status quo either. The victor also, and indirectly, is language. In August 1968, Auden wrote another, much briefer poem, expressing his horror at the invasion of Czechoslovakia. The Ogre, it's called. Actually, it's not called The Ogre, excuse me. It's called August 1968, but I think of it as The Ogre. I can almost do this from memory. I can do it from memory. The ogre does what ogres can, deeds quite impossible for man. But one prize is beyond his reach. The ogre cannot master speech. About a subjugated plain, among its desperate and slain, the ogre stalks with hands on hips while drivel gushes from his lips. That's August 68. 21 years on, that ogre was driven from Prague by irony and ridicule alone. Not a shot was fired. A whole edifice of gibberish melted under the assault of poets and playwrights and essayists. And now the whole ether is full of talk, conversation, information, humor, subversion, and the erotic. I was invited by my hosts to consider saying something this evening about the role of the media. And the only thing I can think of saying is that I think, I hope, that it declines. The role, I mean, not the media. The future, I hope, and in part trust, lies with the unmediated exchange of ideas and information in a universal discourse that requires no gatekeepers or referees. I spend part of my time as a journalist, at least partly because I don't want to rely on the press for information. I get most of my input from individuals, from scholars and eccentrics, and activists and researchers, all of whom can now reach me very easily and communicate vast tranches of prose and fact very fast and very inexpensively. As Brecht said in his very prescient essay on the theory of radio, anything that is a receiver is in principle also a transmitter. And that could be the greatest gain that we are allowed to carry with us from this century to the next. Again, I do not intend to say that we've abolished conflict or contradiction. For one thing, I don't want us to. I don't look forward to a Disneyland Buddhist utopia of bliss and harmony. And wouldn't want to live there if, which I'm glad to find it isn't, it was possible to create one. There will, of course, be efforts made to reestablish monopoly and control and to limit access, just as there will be attempts to use DNA discoveries for new modes of exploitation. But the mental universe, the mental and the moral universe, just like the physical one, is nonetheless expanding. As Galileo said, "E pur si muove," it still moves, all right. I'll close with the words of George Conrad, the great Hungarian essayist and novelist, author of Anti-Politics and The Lover. I'd love to be able to say that those were my two books. Anti-Politics and The Lover. Anyway, he can make this claim. And as a lonely dissident in Budapest in 1987, long before he could possibly have expected his dungeon to shake, he offered the following consolations for the autonomous individual, which is now a group of people that is much larger than we ever thought it was going to be. The sorts of individual of whom, after all, even the masses are composed. We may not, some of us who used to talk passionately of workers' control, be able to talk in such confidence of that concept anymore, but we can talk of self-management as being within the reach of more and more people. And here's George Conrad's, I think, very beautiful suggestion of keeping up this existence in harder times. Have a lived life instead of a career. Put your days in the safekeeping of good taste. Lived freedom will compensate you for a few losses. If you don't like the style of others, cultivate your own. Get to know the tricks of reproduction. Be a self-publisher, even in conversation, and then the joy of working can fill your days. That might sound like a rather quiet note for my peroration, but the sheer fact that this good advice can be intelligibly and extensively followed after all the tumult and the shouting has died is, I think, an achievement of a kind. Thank you very much.
Christopher, your argument for unmediated exchange, it seems to me very sympathetic and captivating, that there is this sense of freedom from clotted, monopolised press machines and media machines. But at the same time, there is a problem of fragmentation of the public, I would have thought, as well. I mean, this movement into new media, which gives you the websites on Burma and places, does it not also create a situation where the places where one might take issues into the public arena to make big themes of them, to mobilise a sort of more general awareness or a more social awareness of what was going on at particular times. Hasn't there been a dispersal in that dimension?
Well, yeah, because nothing comes without cost and everything is and should be dialectical. I mean, I'll give you an example of what I mean. I, for example, like everyone of my age, can remember exactly where I was standing and what I was doing on that terrifying day when President Kennedy nearly killed me. Because I can remember that I have a very strong memory of the Cuba crisis. Of course, there's someone who's worked often in newsrooms or often been woken up at home until turn on the TV, blah, 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 can remember those moments of drama which, you know, did give a common conversation to people. It's true. You were told what to think as well as what was going on. But yes, there were references that could be made. And like any teacher, I find it increasingly tough, especially in America, to be certain that any reference I make, however commonplace it seems to me, will be understood by everyone in the class. And these are graduates in New York in a fairly good school. You can't be certain. And it makes it very hard to try and be ironic or attempt a pun or a play on words. You can't be sure they'll even get the literal. That and the decay of common reference and a common stock of reference is a worry, but I think it's not purchased at an awful price. I mean, I used to turn on CNN compulsorily because I thought I won't know what's going on if I don't, and I used to read and I still do read the New York Times just to find out what everyone else is reading. That's the only reason I read it. I don't read it for information. I don't get any, but at least I know what misapprehension everyone else is under. And that's all part of the great discourse. But in the case of East Timor, it really did happen to me that I was getting better and harder and clearer information right away, straight through my email. I didn't need to resort once to the mass media to find out what was going on. The narrow casting risk is one I think well worth running. You know,
you've spoken harshly about religion. I got the sense that maybe religion and fundamentalism are more or less the same thing. You're not particularly kind to the person reaching through that sort of cultural tradition for any sort of understanding of the world they're in.
No, I'm anti-theistic. In other words, I mean, I'm the. The agnostic-atheist distinction, I think, has been shown by many philosophers to be false. Either you think this stuff is the word of God, or you don't. If you doubt it, it means you don't believe it.
But there is a.
There are some of us who think, thank God, it isn't the word of God.
Yeah, there is. There is.
Thank
there is,
Christ, I'm an atheist. who would not want it to be true, think it sinister, and menacing, and idiotic.
But what is it that that physics? How does physics pick up the tab?
Well, I mean, it occurred to me, when I was watching, I'm sure a lot of people have seen that beautiful film made about the life of Stephen Hawking. It has him investigating in this marvelous way the possible origins of the universe. The event horizon, it must be that if you could work back to the origins of the black hole, you would get to a point that would, sort of, so to speak, be a, well, they call it the event horizon, a lip over which you could fall and in you'd go, and you wouldn't have time, alas. But if you did have time, you'd be able to see the past and the future. And Hawking has a colleague who says that if he knew he had a terminal illness, that's the way he'd want to commit suicide. It would be in the attempt to try and get to the event horizon. So this is, now, compare that to the tripe like the burning bush. The event horizon is a genuinely awe-inspiring thing. And it's obviously not within our compass, and we don't have to say that we are the masters of the universe, and so because we bloody well know that we're not. It's only religion that ever suggested we were. We're not. Religion is claiming to be humble, but in fact extremely solipsistic and arrogant.
What place do you have in your thinking now for politics? I mean, a lot of the trends and the movements that are around at the minute seem to be sort of slightly bio. They're biopolitical. They may be about race or gender or about DNA, even. You talked about this. I mean, but when the political space disappears into the body or moves into the body, you're moving into a sort of area of identities rather than the...
Oh, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah?
For example, I mean, I can remember very, very well. I've led most of my political life on the extreme left, and I'm not ashamed of any of that. I only wish I'd done more, say, about the war in Vietnam or other things. And I can remember, for example, when it was a hot issue to contest the legal ban on homosexual activity. Obviously, who would take back a word of their campaigning against that? However, it has never seemed to me enough for someone to say, I am a gay person, for me to conclude that they've already made a political statement. I think you need to be able to say a bit more than that. There's a certain narcissism involved, seems to be saying, by declaring this. And you can always tell them at meetings, because they stand up and the preface is always, speaking as a. And I would say, well, hold on. What else have you got to say? What work have you done? What thinking have you done? And I know what's about to happen. You're going to tell me how you feel, aren't you? Well, I am only interested in how you think. Enough with feelings, you know. And I'm against the feelings culture. And the first time I ever heard the phrase, the personal is political, I felt a terrible inward cringe, a premonition. And I think I was onto something.
Christopher, you've been writing for many years now. You're dealing with a changing political situation. Do you still feel it's okay to carry on as a writer? I mean, you've got a brother who we all know increasingly well, and there he is, becoming a politician, it seems. I mean, are you tempted to move in that sort of direction?
I was once. I would once have thought it was the highest honour imaginable to be a Member of Parliament. I thought that was what the aspiration of any decent chap should be. And I would have wanted to do it in the Labour interest, as we used to say. But I got chucked out of the Labour Party because of Vietnam again. It keeps coming up. It's one reason why I have no nostalgia for what sometimes called old Labour. In order to have nostalgia for old Labour, it is essential that you were not there when old Labour was. I'm not mad about the new, but I know exactly what I think about the old. So, in a sense, the ambition was stripped from me. So I thought, well, now I'm too fat to sell my body, and I'm too lazy to be a lawyer, and much too lazy to be a doctor. Looks like journalism to me.
A lived life and not a career.
A lived life and not a career.
Let me now open this to the floor. Are there any questions?
My name's Tom Davison. I'd be interested to know your views about the potential for a kind of Orwellian role in political and cultural commentary now, thinking that Orwell created a kind of ordinary man, irascible, well-read, widely thinking personality. Whether he constructed that or whether it was true is something that can be discussed, but it was true to a degree. Commentators now attempted perhaps in two different directions, to be either part of the entertainment industry on TV shows or to be academic experts, which Orwell certainly wasn't. Do you think there is a role for a sort of Orwellian commentator still to think, make people think and argue about politics and culture and books and their interrelation?
That's the question that, in a sense, means more to me than any other one. It's the one you have to answer, or try and answer myself every day. I would say the following. Orwell got, of the three great subjects of the century that's just closing, which are the struggle against fascism, against Stalinism, and not to sound as if one's making a sloganized speech, but against imperialism. I would describe those as the three great political questions at any rate. Orwell is the only person to have got all three of them right. He had no qualifications to do so. Well, he had some credentials as having been an imperial policeman. He hadn't even been to university. So the question anyone who thinks that they're any good has to answer is, well, what were the qualities that allowed him to do that? The main one was not giving a damn what anyone else thought, it seems to me, and deciding that he would back his own convictions and wouldn't be impressed by expertise. and certainly wouldn't be impressed by, say, well, if you tone down the piece a bit, we can give you some money for it and print it. I mean, absolutely wouldn't ever compromise on that. Not a test I think I can always say of. Actually, that one should not think aloud on these occasions. So anyone who cared for the words that George Conrad that I quoted at the end, anyone who felt, well, maybe I could try and lead that kind of life, would have the figure of Orwell, I hope, before them.
My name is Grace Iapolo. You do a superb job in your Vanity Fair columns and in book reviews skewering celebrities or the cult of celebrity. Do you ever worry that you're going to turn into that kind of celebrity yourself?
No, not in the least. I mean, well, it's nice of you to ask, I should say. I think one reason I wouldn't want to be a celebrity is it seems to involve so much living for others. I think it's essential in celebrity life. You have to care what other people think of you. And I think that it's an absolute qualification for trying to do the kind of work I do, that I really and truly now can say that I do not.
Stephanie Kalman, how can human beings be cured, or can they be, of their fatal need to worship?
I'm a completely orthodox Freudian on this point. The future of an illusion is utterly convincing to me. For as long as people cannot be stoical about death, so they will seek to let wish thinking dominate that bit of their consideration. I don't see that it's very likely that mass stoicism about death will ever break out. And so I think we'll have to put up with the fact that people will act as if they're, in this matter, which fortunately can't be tested, so it's to that extent non-threatening, they'll just act as if their wishes counted for more than all the evidence and all the reasoning and all the other glories of human existence. Why not let's just pretend this one time? But it must be resisted, and the fact is the greatest strides have been made in resisting it or holding it off than ever before. I believe it to be. I don't know if I would dare do a test of hands up for an audience like this, but I believe there would be many people here who would say that they regarded themselves as making an honest effort to lead a moral or ethical life without any crutch or stay from a temple, mosque, synagogue, or good dweller. Maybe I should try. Maybe I won't. Well, who would like to say that they felt that about themselves? That's a third isn't bad. That's a fair slice, and put everyone.
But progress is still possible.
But I want to make one more point about this. By definition, everyone who came to that conclusion, more or less, would have had to come to it on their own. In other words, no priesthood, right, is required for this. That I think that may be one of the distinguishing things about humanism. It does not and could not require an inculcating, disciplining, party lining, you know, doctrinaire force. That's also a good sign, if not the best one. Keep it up, comrades. But don't proselytize, okay? There's no need.
So a very quiet plague on priestcraft. Do we have one last question?
The hell with them.
Robin Banerjee, you've been very eloquent about getting rid of censorship, but do you ever worry about that other great terror, dumbing down?
Yes, indeed, I do. It's a useful term, and I realized as soon as I saw it that it had staying power. But the problem with it is, I think, is that there's no process by which it happens. It's quite hard to chase down who's responsible, unlike, say, with censorship. And I also have a feeling, just as I was moaning a bit earlier about how hard it is to find a common stock of references when one teaches and so on, that everyone who's ever been in my position moans that the younger generation don't know jack shit about this and that. And that, I think, that's to be avoided too. I think that at the moment what irritates me so much is that you can't go to see a motion picture unless you are basically a teenager with money. No film is made with you in mind. You're demographically negated, so to speak. But that's only if you want to go to the multiplex, which I don't want to do. And they can't make me do. And nobody I know does do. But there are lots and lots of cinemas, and indeed very large numbers of specialized channels, Narrowcasting is a word invented by Dwight MacDonald in his wonderful essay on mass cult versus mid-cult, where he said that it doesn't matter, there'll always be resources for those who don't want to be swamped to, so to speak, show an affirming flame. And there'll always be people ready to make programs and films and to write books and essays and so on addressed to that audience, which is not at the moment, I think, any smaller than it's ever been, either absolutely or as a proportion. And in fact, may well be growing. So it's one of the things, the struggle against stupidity and the struggle against pointlessness and vulgarity, just as the struggle against censorship and theocracy and so on, is a thing we're never going to not have to do. It's a matter of finding the enjoyment in doing it that I was trying to convey. It's saying, well, this isn't just something you must do and ought to do, but it's something you might quite like to do. And if I've converted any volunteers to that thought this evening, I can rest my old bones with complacency.
We're back in the land of the Minority Report. That brings us to the end of tonight's Sounding the Century lecture. The final lecture in the series will be given by the historian Simon Sharma. But now, with many thanks to tonight's speaker, Christopher Hitchens, I'll say good night from the Purcell Room.
Patrick Wright introduced tonight's Sounding the Century lecture, and the producer was Abigail Appleton. As Patrick mentioned, next